KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Have such a dramatic reduction in the number of people coming across illegally. The numbers for deportation are also going to be way down.
A family in Detroit gets detained at a border crossing for 5 days.
We'll tell you the story this Friday, March 28th on All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. As measles continues to spread in 5 states, there are small signs of vaccine enthusiasm.
Our call center was inundated with calls about MMR vaccine. Is their child up to date? Should they get another vaccine?
Also, fatty acids found on Mars. Could this be a sign of possible past life on the planet?
We're really living kind of a science fiction film, if you will, here. It's just amazing that we can even do this.
And a city in India that has produced some of the world's best chess players.
Those stories and more after this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. A federal judge has blocked the Trump administration from dismantling the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. NPR's Laurel Wamsley reports the ruling is a setback to the Trump administration's efforts to hobble the agency.
Judge Amy Berman Jackson issued a preliminary injunction that orders the government to reinstate the probationary workers who were fired last month and otherwise preserve the agency's operations. The D.C. federal court judge said the injunction is necessary to prevent the administration from eliminating the agency before the court could rule on whether that's allowed. In February, the Trump administration shuttered CFPB headquarters, canceled contracts, and told employees to stop nearly all work. The agency has slowly been allowed to come back to life, though the judge said that was likely a charade for the court's benefit. The Trump administration has made clear it intends to eliminate the agency, which some argue is too heavy-handed in its regulation. Laurel Wamsley, NPR News, Washington.
A federal judge in Washington has temporarily blocked a White House effort to punish the Jenner and Block law firm, calling an executive order by President Trump, quote, disturbing and troubling. The ruling by Judge John Bates came hours after Jenner sued the administration, citing First Amendment free speech violations and an unconstitutional interference in the rights of its clients to set lawyers of its choosing. Trump signed an executive order this week trying to restrict Jenner's access to federal buildings, pull any active security clearances held by its personnel, and direct government employees not to meet with the firm or its members. And in a separate ruling today, a second federal judge issued a temporary restraining order in a related lawsuit brought by the firm WilmerHale against the administration. Meanwhile, another law firm agreed to a deal. Trump says Skadden, Apps, Slate, Meager, and Flom agreed to provide $200 million in pro bono work for causes that Trump supports to avoid an executive order targeting its business. A pair of wildfires have burned more than 10,000 acres in the South Carolina mountains amid conditions that make wildfires almost inevitable. South Carolina Public Radio, Scott Morgan has more.
It's been a week since a fire at Table Rock Mountain ignited and almost a week since a second fire sparked at Persimmon Ridge. Air crews have dropped nearly 750,000 gallons of water, but there has not been any containment. Governor Henry McMaster said conditions have been ideal for a conflagration.
We've never had quite a fire quite like this. We've had some big ones. You've seen the movie The Perfect Storm. Well, this might be the perfect fire.
A combination of dry, windy, sunny days and forest debris is feeding both fires. Trees felled by Hurricane Helene are also impeding access for crews trying to reach parts of the blazes. For NPR News, I'm Scott Morgan in Rock Hill, South Carolina.
Stocks sharply lower on Wall Street by the bell on inflation and tariff worries. The Dow down 715 points. You're listening to NPR News. At least 140 people are dead, hundreds more injured after an earthquake struck central Myanmar. The magnitude 7.7 quake was also felt in China and Thailand, where a building under construction collapsed and has had a devastating impact on the region. Yan Kamsen Brumby has more from Bangkok.
Myanmar's military junta is calling for international humanitarian aid, and several countries, including the United States, have already responded. When asked by reporters, President Trump said, quote, we're going to be helping. State Department spokesperson Tammy Bruce said USAID disaster experts are assessing the requests and reports from the region to shape their response, adding the US was ready to provide aid, including food and water. Myanmar is one of the poorest countries in the world and engaged in an ongoing civil war. and with internet and phone signals cut in many areas, it may take some time to assess the true extent of the damage. For NPR News, I'm Yang Khamtsenbrumby in Bangkok.
They're early, but they are welcome. The famous cherry blossoms in the nation's capital, a gift from Japan in 1912, burst into peak bloom today, thanks to lots of sunshine and weeks of abnormally mild weather. The National Park Service says it's the sixth year in a row that the pink blossoms peaked earlier than normal, but the blooms only last for a few days. Crude oil prices were lower by the close today, down 1.2%, ending at $69.04 a barrel. I'm Janine Herbst, and you're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org. And Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. Immigration rights advocates say that the Trump administration is pushing the limits of what is legal when it comes to immigration enforcement. NPR's Jasmine Garst is following the case of a family in Detroit who made a mistake while driving to the supermarket. A wrong exit turned into a five-day-long ordeal for a mom without legal status and her two young children who are U.S. citizens. The family says it felt like a kidnapping. Jasmine Garst joins us now. Hi, Jazz.
Hi.
So tell us what happened to this family.
So, okay, this is a mixed status family. The mom is a woman named Sarai. She's an immigrant from Guatemala without legal status, and she requested her last name be withheld because she is afraid of retaliation. Mm-hmm. Her two daughters are ages 1 and 5. They are American citizens. They live in Detroit. And so on a Saturday morning earlier this month, Sarai and her daughters got into the car to go to Costco, you know, buy some groceries, get some lunch. Mm-hmm. But Sarai says she typed in the wrong Costco location in her phone's navigation. She realized too late she was driving to the Costco on the other side of the border in Canada.
Wow.
Which led to their arrest by Customs and Border Protection.
Okay. And I guess so far this sounds like what's been standard immigration practice for years now, right? Like someone in the country illegally gets detained at a border crossing.
Yeah. Yes, yes. In prior years, Sarai, who has no criminal record, would likely be released with a notice to appear in immigration court. But that's not what happened. Instead, they were all taken to a Customs and Border Protection building right by the border between the toll plaza and the bridge that connects Windsor, Canada, and Detroit. And they were held there for over 5 days in an office space with no windows, a space that is not built for detention, much less for children. Yeah. And at no point were they allowed to speak to a lawyer or to her consulate. I spoke about this experience with Sarai.
Yo les decía, quiero un abogado que, porque ustedes mismos han dicho que también puedo tener abogado.
She says, I would tell the agents, I want a lawyer. You told me when you arrested me that I could have a lawyer. She says it felt like a kidnapping. And she says around the third day in detention, both kids started getting sick. It was quite cold in the facilities. They were mostly being fed instant ramen. And she says she started pleading with agents, please release my daughters, who again are American citizens.
Right. Well, have immigration officials responded to NPR about this whole case?
Yes. In a statement, Customs and Border Protection told NPR, quote, when individuals violate immigration laws, their choices make them subject to detention and removal. And they say Sarai's initial decision to keep her kids with her extended her detention time. Now, what happened to this family may have been legal under U.S. law, and the agency says it followed protocol, but lawyers NPR interviewed say this raises serious questions. Her children were held in conditions the U.S. has previously deemed unacceptable to minors.
God, I'm just wondering, like, how often are cases like this one happening? Do we have any idea?
Immigration lawyers I spoke to told me they believe this is becoming a more widespread practice during Trump's second term, and that it's an example of enforcement pushing the boundaries of the law. I mean, for example, typically detentions at ports of entry are very temporary, a couple of hours, maybe a day. For this family, it was close to a week without a lawyer, which is a right for everyone in the U.S., regardless of immigration status.
That is NPR's Jasmine Garce. Thank you so much, Jazz.
Thanks for having me.
This is the final week of Ramadan, a sacred month for Muslims. It's a time for fasting during the day and feasts in the evening with family. In Gaza, Ramadan this year has been spent among rubble, evacuating areas under Israeli assault and burying loved ones. NPR producer Anas Baba reports from Gaza.
It's 2 a.m. Three young men are walking through one of Gaza's destroyed neighborhoods. One beats a drum, carried over his shoulder. The other two sing Islamic chants. They're loud, and that's the point. They are waking up people, reminding them to eat before another day of fasting begins at dawn. Ramadan in Gaza has also sounded like this. Israel resumed war in Gaza on the second week of Ramadan. Gaza health officials say airstrikes have killed nearly 1,000 people, including hundreds of children. The military ordered people to flee their homes again. A brief ceasefire had brought hope the war might end, but that hope has now been shattered. Issam Zakut says he doesn't know whether to flee his home or stay. He says this is psychological warfare. People are struggling to find food. Israel allowed humanitarian aid to flow into Gaza during the brief ceasefire. But for the past month, it's imposed a blockade on Gaza, barring all aid, even food, from entering. Israel says it's to pressure Hamas. Rights groups say it's collective punishment for civilians. Aid groups are now rationing supplies. The United Nations is pulling staff out of Gaza. Hungry and tired people gather in front of a community kitchen. Fouad Nassar says before the war, he would break his fast with chicken, fish, and kebabs. Now, he spends 2 hours in line for beans. Ran Al Abadi is using canned food to cook a meal among piles of concrete debris. Her apartment building was destroyed in an Israeli strike. Before the war, Palestinian dishes of spiced chicken, rice, and vegetables were served every night of Ramadan. But now, she's making pizza using canned food, mushrooms, corn, sauce, and cheese. She removed the microwave's insides and turned it into an oven. Lighting a fire using foam from bed mattresses her husband collected from under the rubble around the neighborhood. A lot of burnt foam sticks to her pizza dough. That's what her children will eat tonight. She wants to make them happy any way she can. She has no other choice. She says before, Ramadan was full of variety, colors, and flavors. Now, we barely have anything. At the beginning of the holy month, some families gathered outdoors for free Ramadan meals organized by an Egyptian charity. Now, daily Israeli airstrikes make it too dangerous to gather like this. And in war, there is nothing to celebrate. But during that 1 week of Ramadan, families were able to gather together after months of displacement. They lost so much, but children played. It was quality time with the vibe of a family reunion. just one moment where they could forget everything and enjoy a Ramadan meal together without war. For NPR News, I'm Anas Baba in Gaza.
So, a science experiment aboard NASA's Curiosity rover has found tantalizing traces of possible past life on Mars.
We're really living kind of a science fiction film, if you will, here. It's just amazing that we can even do this.
Daniel Glavin is an astrobiologist with NASA. Cool job. And he's part of the team that has detected the largest organic molecules ever found on the red planet.
The molecules came from a sample of 3.7 billion-year-old Martian mudstone dug up in Gale Crater, the site of an ancient lake. Glavin says the compounds could be the remnants of what's called fatty acids.
What's a fatty acid? These are components of cells. The cell membrane includes fatty acids, so these are really important and critical building blocks of life.
But before you get too excited, there could be other explanations for where these things came from.
They could have been delivered to Gale Crater by meteorites. They can also be formed by kind of natural geological processes. And then the third possibility is that we're looking at the ancient chemical remnants of life, that biology actually built these fatty acids.
He says there's only one way to know for sure.
A next logical step here is to bring back samples from Mars, bring them home so we can finally get at this age-old question about whether or not there was ever life on Mars.
Doing so will be a journey, but that's nothing new for Glavin. This new discovery took more than a decade to come to fruition.
We first drilled this ancient Martian mudstone sample in May of 2013. And here we are now, almost 13 years later, where we're finally able to report the discovery.
Their findings appear in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences.
So, what's next? Well, the first part of that sample return mission, it's already underway. A different Mars rover called Perseverance landed on the planet back in 2021, and it's been collecting tubes of dust and rock and packing them in its belly.
Sometime in the future, another spacecraft will land on Mars, take those tubes, and blast into Martian orbit. Then a second spacecraft will rendezvous in orbit, bring the samples back to Earth, and drop them in Utah. Well, that's the plan, at least.
If everything goes perfectly, this would happen in the mid-2030s, 2035. But again, a lot has to go right. The only thing that we've done here is we've demonstrated we can land on Mars. So launching off the surface of Mars, orbiting with a sample in Mars orbit, rendezvousing, capturing it, all that is basically the first time we would ever demonstrated that.
So it may be a while before scientists on Earth have Mars dust in their hands, but the fact that these molecules endured billions of years on Mars, that indicates any traces of past life can probably wait a few more years, right? Until Earthlings figure out how to bring these samples home.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Dignity Memorial, helping families today to protect their loved ones tomorrow. Planning celebrations of life in advance can give families peace of mind. Learn more at dignitymemorial.com. From Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on Thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ilse Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. The Trump administration is stepping up its campaign to end diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts, not just within the government, but in the private sector as well. This week, the Labor Department sent out an email saying it would scrutinize federal contractors to see if any of their policies violate Trump's anti-DEI executive orders or federal law. NPR's Andrea Hsu has more.
The email was sent by Catherine Eschbach. She's the new head of the Office of Federal Contract Compliance Programs, known as OFCCP. For decades, that office worked to ensure that companies that do business with the government comply with anti-discrimination laws. In her note to staff, Eschbach wrote, "The reality is most of what OFCCP has been doing was out of step, if not flat out contradictory to our country's laws." We should note Eschbach was recently doing work for a federal contractor. She represented Elon Musk's SpaceX in a lawsuit against the government. Now, the skepticism about the work of this office, it wasn't a thing in the first Trump administration. In fact,
I would say it was the high watermark of OFCCP.
That's Craig Lean, a partner with K&L Gates, who headed the office during Trump's first term.
We helped a lot of workers. We helped a lot of businesses comply with the law.
He said they did more audits and got quicker resolutions when they found disparities in pay or in how people were being treated. Over 4 years, the office recovered $117 million in remedies for workers.
There were more settlements during that time period than, I believe, any other time period in OFCCP history by far.
A lot of their work was tied to a 1965 executive order that Trump revoked in January. It required federal contractors to take steps to identify and address barriers to employment. So, for example, if a company had very few women in its ranks, despite there being plenty of women qualified for the jobs, they needed to ask themselves,
what's going on here? Is there a stereotype taking place? Are we not recruiting women? Do women feel like this is not a work site that they want to be at?
Companies also had to create what are known as affirmative action plans, detailing how they would reach a diverse pool of candidates.
Maybe you go to women's job fairs. Maybe you publish in magazines that are more likely to be read by women. The goal is to get more applicants.
Now, Craig Lean is very clear. Federal contractors cannot use preferences or quotas or set-asides.
You cannot have a preference for race or gender in hiring. You must hire based on merit.
And that's been true this whole time. But now in Trump's second term, it's come into sharper focus. The Labor Department declined to answer questions about OFCCP's strategy. But in her email to staff, Eschbach said they're now going to examine whether companies' affirmative action plans are themselves discriminatory. Jenny Yang, who headed the office under Biden, is highly doubtful of that.
The overwhelming majority of these practices are fully lawful.
And Yang points out some of the money recovered was for underpaid white men. Craig Lean says the same was true during Trump's first term.
25% of the recoveries were for men and white employees, 25%.
While investigations have more often turned up discrimination against people of color, Lean points out under federal law, being white is also a protected class.
Just as much as being Black or Hispanic or Asian or Native American or Pacific Islander.
If anything, Lean thinks companies now need to be more vigilant. He's counseling clients to do a thorough review of their DEI programs. He says they need to be sure there are no preferences or quotas and that those programs don't exclude anybody based on race, gender, or other protected characteristics.
Once you've done that, you have the right to have that program. It's protected by the First Amendment. You just want to make sure that it's inclusive of all employees.
That, he says, is a best practice. Andrea Hsu, NPR News.
And President Trump has taken another step to reshape workplaces. Late last night, he signed an executive order ending collective bargaining rights for workers at some 20 federal agencies. The White House says the president has the authority to do so at agencies which missions involve national security. Unions have roundly condemned the move. Everett Kelly, president of the American Federation of Government Employees, spoke outside the Capitol today.
Invoking national security as justification for this action is a ridiculous pretext, not a legal reason.
Unions have vowed to fight the order in court.
Earlier this week, ICE arrested a Turkish student studying at Tufts University on a valid visa. The U.S. government accuses Rumeysa Ozturk of supporting Hamas. Her lawyers say her detention is an attempt to suppress free speech. But what has struck many people is that the officers who arrested her were wearing masks. We asked NPR law enforcement correspondent Martin Kosty to sort through this, and he joins us now. Hi, Martin.
Hi, Elsa.
Okay, this arrest, it was caught on video. And for those people who have not seen this video, can you just describe what it shows?
Yeah, well, there are two videos out there of her arrest. The one I'm going to talk about here was obtained by a freelance reporter named Daniel Bogoslav from the person who filmed it in a house nearby. It shows Ms. Ozturk on a sidewalk in Somerville, Massachusetts, as she's surrounded by three men and three women in street clothes. And you can see that most of them have badges. Most of them are also, most of them are also masked. And you can listen to the reaction here from the man who's filming them from his porch.
Is this a kidnapping? Can I see some faces here? How do I know this is the police?
In that video, you can also see that their masks are actually those neck gaiters that people sometimes wear around their necks and pull over their faces in cold weather. One officer kind of looks up at the camera, sees it, and pulls his gaiter up over his nose.
Wait, and the man who shot this video, did he really think it was a kidnapping?
I asked him that. We're not using his name here because he's worried about repercussions for criticizing ICE. And he says he assumed it was a government operation, but he says on a moral level, he also considers it to have been a kidnapping because why else would police hide their faces? And that's a sentiment that's been shared by a lot of people who've seen this video.
Well, Martin, I mean, why would these officers hide their faces? Like, what are the rules for law enforcement when it comes to wearing masks?
Local police generally aren't supposed to wear anything that's not part of their official uniforms, but there are exceptions for tactical teams or cold weather. Those neck gaiters especially occupy kind of a gray zone because during the pandemic, a lot of officers wore them instead of medical masks. But generally speaking, American cops are supposed to have their badges and their faces visible.
Okay, cops, but this was apparently an ICE operation, right? So what are the rules for immigration officers?
Well, we asked ICE and they wouldn't answer questions about this. We couldn't find any mask rules in publicly available ICE handbooks, and retired ICE agents tell me that they don't recall ever being told they couldn't wear masks. But it should also be noted here that these might not have been full-time ICE agents. Lately, ICE has been borrowing people from other federal agencies, such as the U.S. Marshals and the Drug Enforcement Administration. And I'm told some of these immigration arrests are being done by people who usually do other kinds of investigations or even undercover work. And they would have a professional interest in not having their faces on the internet.
Well, in your reporting on police, do you get a sense that police attitudes, law enforcement attitudes towards masks are shifting?
I think they are, in some contradictory ways, maybe. Police chiefs have been fretting about how pandemic masks made it easier for criminals to hide their faces. Historically, many states have restricted masks in public, in part because of the legacy of groups such as the Ku Klux Klan. With the pandemic behind us, though, you do get some sense that there's a return or a desire to go back to some kind of restrictions on masks. But police also share some of the fears of campus protesters who masked up last year. But of course, when a police officer puts on a mask, it has a very different effect.
Absolutely. That is NPR's Martin Kosty. Thank you, Martin.
You're welcome.
This is NPR News.
Plainclothes federal agents have arrested international students and academics who engaged in political protests supporting Gaza. Former Education Secretary John B. King Jr. says the arrests are chilling.
You don't want people to be afraid to speak up, and you don't want people to be afraid to come to the United States to study.
I'm Emily Kwong, and that's All Things Considered from NPR News.
We'll be right back.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. An executive order directs the vice president to eliminate, quote, divisive, race-centered ideology from the Smithsonian Institution.
It misrepresents the work of the Smithsonian, which is one of the great research institutions in the world.
First, these news headlines.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. During a visit to a U.S. military base in Greenland today, Vice President J.D. Vance said the semi-autonomous island would be better off if it were part of the United States. And NPR's Franco Ordonez tells us it's the Trump administration's latest play for the Danish territory.
J.D. Vance said Greenland has a right to self-determination, but insisted that Greenlanders would be safer and richer under the U.S. security umbrella.
Our message to Denmark is very simple. You have not done a good job by the people of Greenland. You have underinvested in the people of Greenland, and you have underinvested in the security architecture of this incredible, beautiful landmass filled with incredible people.
Vance said he did not anticipate the U.S. would forcibly annex the territory, but that the U.S. taking control was a matter of national security. He cited Russia and China's interest in gaining control of Arctic passageways and Arctic naval routes. Franco Ordonez, NPR News.
Dozens of wildfires continue to burn in the southeast and southern plains as downed trees and brush from past hurricanes are being whipped up by high winds and extreme drought conditions. From West Virginia, Tennessee, and Georgia to the Carolinas, many counties are under red flag warnings, meaning conditions are ripe for fires. Scott Phillips is a South Carolina state forester. He predicts a long season ahead.
We are just at the beginning of our wildfire season here in South Carolina. We're 28 days in. We haven't even made it to April 1st yet. April is the month that we tend to have our biggest wildfires here in South Carolina.
Much of Florida is in drought, contributing to an earlier-than-normal fire season there. That included a major brush fire in Miami-Dade County this week that briefly hindered travel to and from the Florida Keys. You're listening to NPR News. Utah is the first state in the nation to ban fluoride from public drinking water after the state's Republican governor yesterday signed a bill into law from member station KUER. Sean Higgins reports.
Fluoride has been used as an additive in drinking water for decades and is widely seen as an effective way to prevent cavities, especially in communities without easy access to dental care. But state lawmakers here cited some research that suggests exposure to fluoride at twice the recommended level can be associated with lower IQs in children. Fluoride has also been a target of Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and the American Dental Association recommend water fluoridation. The bill received pushback from dentists across the state. Under Utah's ban, anyone who wants to obtain additional fluoride can still do so at a pharmacy or dental office. For NPR News, I'm Sean Higgins in Salt Lake City.
A federal judge is temporarily blocking parts of the Trump administration's efforts to do away with diversity, equity, and inclusion programs, or DEI, for government contractors or grant recipients, to be specific. That ruling comes in response to a lawsuit filed by a Chicago nonprofit that has several contracts with the Department of Labor. Stocks finished broadly lower to end the week on Wall Street. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Bank of America, From local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ailsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Juana Summers in Washington. The Trump administration continues to move swiftly to eliminate what President Trump calls anti-American ideology from America's cultural institutions. Yesterday, the latest executive order targeted the Smithsonian and the memorials and monuments overseen by the Department of the Interior. Joining us now to unpack what's going on is NPR culture correspondent Elizabeth Blair. Hi there.
Hi, Juana.
So, Elizabeth, just start if you can by telling us what this order says.
The order is called Restoring Truth and Sanity to American History. It's essentially calling for an overhaul of the Smithsonian and an evaluation of federal monuments. The Smithsonian is a vast complex that includes the Air and Space Museum, the Natural History Museum, the National Museum of the American Indian, the Cooper Hewitt in New York, and several other museums and research centers. The executive order claims that the Smithsonian has, quote, come under the influence of a divisive race-centered ideology, and then it promotes narratives that portray American and Western values as inherently harmful and oppressive. I talked to Jim Grossman, executive director of the American Historical Association. He says Trump's executive order is neither truth nor sanity.
It misrepresents the work of the Smithsonian, which is one of the great research institutions in the world. Arguing that the Smithsonian somehow misleads people, somehow is unpatriotic, somehow is saying things that are not true, that's simply not true.
Still, the order says no future federal dollars can be spent on anything that at the Smithsonian that degrades, quote, shared American values. It also says that the as yet unbuilt Women's History Museum will not recognize men as women in any respect.
Elizabeth, how much authority can the U.S. president exert over the content in Smithsonian museums?
The Smithsonian is governed by a board of regents. It includes the Chief Justice of the United States and the Vice President. It also includes 3 senators, 3 representatives, and 9 citizen members appointed by Congress. So while the U.S. president is not a member of the board of regents, his VP is. The executive order says the Vice President will work with Congress to appoint citizens that agree with the administration, and it threatens to withhold federal funding, which is critical to the Smithsonian.
Right. Well, what has the Smithsonian had to say about all of this?
The Smithsonian has not yet released a statement.
Okay. We also mentioned federal monuments. What does the order have to say about them?
Trump's order asked the Department of the Interior to take a look at federal monuments to make sure they don't, quote, perpetuate a false reconstruction of American history or include any other improper partisan ideology. It also calls for reinstating monuments that have been removed to improperly minimize or disparage certain historical figures or events. The Interior Department has not yet responded to NPR's request for comment, but we presume he's talking about monuments that were torn down because many people found them offensive. After the murder of George Floyd, more than 150 Confederate symbols were removed across the United States.
That was NPR's Elizabeth Blair. Elizabeth, thank you.
Thank you.
It took the cooperation of several countries last summer for the U.S. and Russia to complete the largest prisoner swap since the Cold War. Paul Whelan, a 55-year-old retired U.S. Marine, was freed in that exchange. He had been held for more than 5 years. But since returning home to Michigan, he says he still feels trapped, this time in a web of bureaucracy. WDET's Quinn Kleinfelter explains.
Last August, a crowd of reporters and photographers gathered at Andrews Air Force Base in Maryland and trained their cameras on a small plane that had just touched down. The first to emerge was a tall, light-haired man with glasses who steadied himself on the hand railings before he snapped off a crisp salute.
It was Paul Whelan, who has been serving a sentence for years.
A CNN announcer described Whelan's actions.
Now embracing the President of the United States of America after a lengthy conversation as he's turning his head towards the family members that await him, waving back to the crowd as America waves back.
But Whelan says the excitement about his return soon faded.
What we found
is that once you're home, you're actually on your own. You know, the attention turns on the next guy that's still locked up somewhere abroad.
Whelan was arrested on false espionage charges in December of 2018 and waited years to be freed while the U.S. negotiated the release of other American captives. After the first year of his detention, his employer, BorgWarner, cut his job as director of global security and his insurance coverage. When he finally arrived home, Whelan found that he did not qualify for unemployment because he had not worked in Michigan recently.
Well, I was working, but I was working in a Russian labor camp, and that apparently doesn't count.
A member of Congress had to contact Michigan's Secretary of State just for Whelan to get a driver's license and identification. And being convicted of a crime in Russia, even a crime the U.S. government declared was bogus, created problems.
When I applied for a renewal of my global entry card, which comes from Customs and Border Patrol, I had a hard time with them because they kept focusing on the fact that, well, you were arrested and you were imprisoned overseas. And I said, yeah, and look at the pictures of the president meeting me at Andrews Air Force Base when I came back.
Strangest of all, he says, was when he tried to get full Medicaid coverage through the state.
I had applied for medical care and I had a letter back saying that I didn't qualify because I wasn't a U.S. citizen. It makes you scratch your head, to be quite honest. I mean, how could somebody have sent that to me? But they did. And I said, you know, you could just Google my name right now.
It's not supposed to be that difficult for returning hostages. Congress created the Levinson Act specifically to provide medical and other help to them and their families for 5 years after their release. But Congress never funded it. Michigan Congresswoman Haley Stevens says there's a bipartisan effort to add that appropriation.
Someone like Paul Whelan, 5.5 years taken from him. If he was wrongfully in prison in the United States, he'd arguably get compensation. Paul Whelan right now is living off of a GoFundMe, and it's unacceptable, and it's wrong.
Whelan lives with his elderly parents in the small village of Manchester, roughly 60 miles southwest of Detroit, and he says he literally depends on the kindness of strangers. At the Manchester Diner, owner Leslie Kirkland has a job tip, offering to connect Whelan with a regular customer who runs a cybersecurity company.
Try and talk to him this weekend. I know he'll come in for chicken and waffles, and I can see if he's got something for you or he can put you in the right direction for something.
Whelan smiles, then glances at his phone. He's just got a message from another former hostage, one of several who text each other regularly, seeking advice and encouragement.
It's a small community, but we keep in touch. Sort of like a group of misfit toys.
Whelan talks about support he's received from the community, the car dealers who've offered him a leased vehicle, and the private practitioners that provided him with some medical and dental help.
But the reality is that when you get off the plane, you find that your former life isn't there. The homes that we've left are not the homes that we come back to. It's a process of putting puzzle pieces together yourself.
Whelan says if he can help the government develop new methods to support anyone else who might be detained, maybe his half decade in the darkest corners of the Russian prison system will count for more than just time taken away from him. For NPR News, I'm Quinn Kleinfelter in Detroit.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Today brings the first of three funerals for the teenage victims of last Friday's mass shooting in Las Cruces, New Mexico. Three of four suspects arrested are also teens, and New Mexico Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham is telling state lawmakers to expect a special legislative session focused on public safety. Johnny Coker with member station KRWG in Las Cruces reports, and a warning. The story includes the sound of gunshots.
The shooting happened at what Las Cruces police are calling an unsanctioned car show at Young Park, a popular live music and events venue. The meetups have become common at the park. Enthusiasts show off their vehicles and sometimes skid around the parking lot in chaotic and dangerous fashion, as shown in this video obtained by Las Cruces police. These car shows have prompted police intervention in the past. Last Friday, an altercation at one of the meetups turned into a barrage of gunfire, as recorded in cell phone video also cited by police.
Oh no!
3 teenagers were shot and killed. 15 others were wounded. 21-year-old Zanaya Hernandez was at the event with her brother.
They did shoot our car. They did get our car and our tire. I mean, I'm okay. My brother's okay.
4 suspects have been arrested so far, 3 of them juveniles. Hernandez says the event was packed.
And then out of nowhere, just people were dead, families are hurt. And
New Mexico Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham says there needs to be a special state legislative session on public safety in wake of the shooting. She tried one last year. It only lasted 5 hours, and lawmakers bypassed most of her agenda. Lujan Grisham called it, quote, one of the most disappointing days in her career.
Police chiefs from across the state and the New Mexico Association of Chiefs of Police have been screaming from the rooftops about a very serious juvenile violent crime problem we have in New Mexico.
This is Las Cruces Police Chief Jeremy Story at a press conference a few days after the shooting.
This is not about politics, but it is about policy.
Story has been advocating for criminal justice reform since last year. He wants lawmakers to make it easier for district attorneys to try juveniles as adults for some serious crimes.
DAs across New Mexico have been sounding the alarm on juvenile crime, yet nothing meaningful was accomplished at our last legislative session to address these dire concerns.
Governor Lujan Grisham has not yet formally called a new special session. Meanwhile, Las Cruces mourns.
It's your man, King Islands, so we pour out our praise.
Local pastor Joshua De La O helped organize this vigil for victims shortly after the shooting.
Even if people weren't involved and weren't there, there's always a sense of insecurity, a sense of fear. So even that, overcoming that as a community, we have a lot of work ahead of us there.
The 3 people killed in the shooting were 16-year-old Andrew Madrid, 18-year-old Jason Gomez, and 19-year-old Dominic Estrada. A memorial for one of the victims is today, followed by a vigil organized by a local social justice nonprofit. Zanaya Hernandez, who witnessed the shooting, says car meets like the one it happened at aren't the problem.
We can still have fun. We can still get together. We can show off our cars without families getting hurt, without people, you know, dropping to the ground.
For NPR News, I'm Johnny Coker in Las Cruces, New Mexico.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thank you.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Scott Detrow. All right, here is something that you probably hear a lot when someone talks about a book that got made into a movie. The book is better, to the point that it's honestly pretty impressive when a movie can come close or even surpass the original source material. Why is that? And is it even true? I don't know. To talk about it, I brought in two people I love talking about books with. It is NPR's Book of the Day podcast host, Andrew Limbong. Hey, Andrew.
Hey, what's up, Scott?
And NPR editor, Barry Hardiman. Hey, Barry.
Hey, how's it going?
Why don't we start with both of you with that first question? The book is always better than the movie. True or false, Barry?
Utterly false. Utterly false. And in fact, I try really hard not to say the book was better when I have that feeling. I try to say, oh, have you also read the book? Because there are so many wonderful adaptations. Mm-hmm. And I really feel kind of strongly that we should not, as a book lover, do not be that person. And in general, the whole idea is that there's two creative enterprises, right? There's the person who wrote the book, which is its own thing, and then the person who wrote the screenplay and then conceived of the light and the acting and all that other stuff. They're different.
Andrew, are you going to agree or disagree?
I don't live in absolutes.
Then why are you even here?
Yeah, come on. Let's get some hot takes. I obviously think it's definitely different. I will say, if you have a feeling, a certain emotional attachment to a book, it's kind of hard to watch a movie and have someone else's take be that take. And so I understand where the inclination comes from. I just think it's incorrect.
I think we can all agree. It is hard, especially like the bigger a book is, the harder it is to create a movie out of it. Why do you think that is?
There's a certain amount of ego death and there's a certain amount of egoism, right? As it depending on, you know, the sort of like background, what kind of like hands the author generally doesn't have that much say over it. But I think if they like have to necessarily kill themselves, like not literally, obviously, in order to just like let this bird fly. And then also you as a filmmaker have to have enough ego to say, hey, you know that book I really loved? I'm going to change it drastically in order to fit this different medium.
Yeah, I will say, I think that there's faithful and there's loyal, right? Like there are sort of two different ways to think about how much you're going to try to hold on to the word by word versus the intention. And then you lose like the possibility of creative genius. Like one of the great things about the Gen X Romeo and Juliet, the Leonardo DiCaprio one, is that it actually does something I've never seen on stage. And I'm calling this a book in this case. But I've never seen where Juliet wakes up before Leonardo actually dies. So they have a moment where they connect. I've never seen that on stage.
Poison. Didn't call and left no friendly drop to help me after.
Talk about ability to like to have real ego on the filmmaker's part, Baz Luhrmann, lots of that, and say, I have this real idea and I'm going to do something different than William, I want to say...
Frickin' Shakespeare.
Yeah. Exactly. I couldn't think
I
of
did. I watched his. I tried to watch his Great Gatsby movie with Leo in it. Mm. Bro, I had to tap out.
Yeah. Actually, my eighth grader said the same thing.
Yeah. Too much.
Yeah.
So, setting that Great Gatsby movie aside...
Yeah.
Past quarter century have given us a lot of examples of really iconic books that become iconic movies, and they live together in different ways. Like, you could argue the Lord of the Rings trilogy, the movies expanded on it. They made it a bigger cultural thing. They became their own thing that I think some would argue supplanted. I'm actually somebody who, like, actually ignores the movies and loves the books and repeatedly rereads the books.
I forgot.
I appreciate the movies. I'm not a hater on the movies. They just don't have the same attachment for me, even though I'm, like, the exact age of people who love the movies. Right, so there's that. There's the Harry Potter movies, which I think they're kind of like dual tracks, you know? Mm. And then let's throw another example in Twilight, where I feel like the movies just, like, did not hit the books in the same level. Like, what do you think these tell us about, like, when it works, when it doesn't work? Maybe you disagreed with everything I said.
No, I just, well, first of all, I'm trying to think of a way not to say that I think that the Lord of the Rings movies are better.
That's fair.
Straight to your face.
It's fair.
Because I really do think they improve on the books. And I know the books are beloved and important. But the other one is I think that the first Twilight movie is much better than the book. In fact, it's a great example of when the source material is beloved, but maybe a little not as sharp. You know, the books were a moment, but they aren't like high art in and of themselves.
I think that's a fair statement.
Yeah, but I actually think that the first one is great. There's tons of chemistry.
I know what you are.
Say it.
Vampire.
They gave the book something that they didn't actually have.
I think we don't often think of the MCU movies as literary adaptations.
Ooh. Most of the intelligence community doesn't believe he exists. The ones that do call him the Winter Soldier.
I was a kid when Winter Soldier came out, like the comic books. And those were a big deal to me. And Civil War was a big deal to me. And turning those into gigantic movies that I was a comic book kid, and that all of a sudden, like, normal people, hot, good-looking people were also into this thing that I was into. I think these adaptations of books have a way of spreading the gospel, so to speak, of what makes this stuff so good.
Yeah, no, that's such a good point.
You both talked about a couple examples, but is there any other example that you feel like is, like, the best movie to point to when it's just like, this is an adaptation, but it is far, far, far out there, like, stretching the bounds of any sort of relationship at all, and yet still works?
I think for me, and this is an old one, but The French Lieutenant's Woman, which is a John Fowles book, and is the first book of, yes, I'm going to say this word, metafiction. I try not to ever say it, though. I don't. I really do. And I loved it. And the adaptation with Meryl Streep and Jeremy Irons, which I think is like an 80s adaptation, is so fascinating because, the book is telling this love story in different layers, different ways it could be told. It's interacting in all these different levels. And the movie is doing it with the actors. So the actors are having this relationship at the same time that they are telling the story of the story. It's such a creative way to do it. And once you see it, you think, oh, there's no other way this movie could have been made.
I'm thinking you said metafiction. I thought immediately about that last part in Killers of the Flower Moon, where Scorsese himself shows up.
Mrs. Molly Cobb, 50 years of age, passed away at 11 o'clock Wednesday night at her home. She was a full-blood Osage.
And kind of was like, this is the story I'm telling you, this is why I'm telling you, this is why I have to kind of like put my chips in and tell this story, which is something that, like, you know, you obviously, the David Grand book is pretty like, just the facts, ma'am, and sort of like tells it. And then him like introducing this sort of authorial intent on adapting that book, I think changes the entire movie in retrospect in a really interesting way.
Yeah,
that's a good point.
I fell asleep 2.5 hours into that movie. I didn't get to this point.
No, I feel you. I had a whole popcorn situation. I had a whole strategy in.
Yeah,
like
the
Swedish fish were not going to be opened until like.
That's smart.
Hours in.
I just did it in 2 nights.
That is NPR's Andrew Limbong and Barry Hardiman. We could have talked for another 6 hours. Thanks for coming by.
We probably will.
Great, thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Sony Pictures Classics, presenting The Penguin Lessons, a new comedy starring Steve Coogan as a teacher whose life is upended after he rescues a penguin from an oil-slicked beach, now playing in theaters. From Fisher Investments, Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Easy Cater, committed to helping organizations order and manage food for all their business needs. With online ordering from restaurants nationwide, employee meal programs, and tools to control food expenses. At Easy Cater.